Hi, this is Alan Chartok. Joining us today is Tim Seney, the District Attorney of Suffolk County, New York. DA is here to talk to us about the remarkable story of Keith Bush, a man who has been exonerated for murder and attempted rape after 44 years. The case marks the longest-running murder case to be overturned in New York State history. District Attorney Tim Seney, welcome. We're delighted to be talking to you, sir. How long have you been DA?
I took office January 2018, so we're about a year and a half in.
And before that, you were police commissioner.
Yes, of Suffolk County. I was police commissioner for about 2 years, and then prior to that, I was a federal prosecutor in the Southern District of New York.
Wow. And what position did you hold in the Southern District, which is now certainly the district that we're all watching because of what's going on with Donald Trump?
It has gotten some publicity. I was in the violent crime unit. I specialized in homicide prosecutions, gang prosecutions, and large-scale narcotics trafficking.
Right. So you know all about the Central Park Five, for example, and they turned out not to do it. So I guess the fact is that we don't have a death penalty is a good thing.
Look, I mean, in terms of the integrity of convictions, it's very important that we are looking at past convictions where there are actual claims of innocence and where we can correct a past injustice. We must do that. And when you consider the death penalty and the finality of the death penalty, you make an excellent point.
You know, I've always felt personally that the thing that has always convinced me about the death penalty, not doing it, is exactly that. Look, if somebody kills your kid, obviously, you know, you may justifiably want them dead. Now, a lot of people give me a hard time about that. But if, in fact, it turns out they didn't do it, you just can't take it back.
That's right. And, you know, Keith Bush is a good example of correcting a past injustice. You know, here's someone who spent 33 years in prison and was denied parole over and over again because essentially he maintained his innocence.
So tell us the story.
Sure. So this dates back to 1975. It's a murder in Suffolk County, January 10th, 1975, in Belport. There's a house party. And a young woman, a young girl, a 14-year-old girl named Charisse Watson, had attended that party. And a boy, Keith Bush, 17 at the time, also attended that party, along with about 100 attendees. And Charisse Watson left that party approximately 1:30 a.m. And she walked towards her home, and someone attempted to rape her. And she fought back, and that person killed her. She was found a couple days later in a field with puncture wounds in her lower back and other bruises to her face. The autopsy revealed that she was killed by strangulation, and she had these unique puncture wounds on her lower back. Most of them were in a series of three holes. So a high-profile murder. It's a young girl.
African-American?
African-American girl. And to fast forward, Keith Bush is also African-American. Most of the attendees at the party are African-American. This is an African-American community. Still is to this day, Belport, North Belport area. It's a high-profile murder. And you have a young girl, 14-year-old girl, found dead in a field in Suffolk County in the 70s, right? So Newsday is publicizing this. In fact, it's a front-page story in Newsday. Within a few days, police hone in on their suspect.
And what's the town now?
It's still Belport.
Belport, yeah.
It's in Suffolk County. It's about 45 minutes. When you get to the western border of Suffolk, Nassau-Suffolk border, it's about 45 minutes east into Suffolk, sort of mid-Suffolk when you consider the east end to the western end. So they hone in on Keith Bush, and they do so because a woman named Sharon Carlos basically says she sees Charisse talking to Mr. Bush prior to her leaving. And so they hone in on Mr. Bush, and they end up bringing him in for questioning. What's interesting is they talk to another girl named Maxine Bell, and she's a runaway. In fact, reported missing at the time of the party. Nonetheless, Maxine Bell says, allegedly, to the police that she was at the party, and she saw Keith Bush and the murder victim, Charisse Watson, leave the party together. So the police now are super hyper-focused on Keith Bush as a suspect. They bring him in for questioning, and this is where the story becomes divergent. The police say that he signs a confession. Essentially, that confession is that he leaves the party with Miss Watson. He attempts to have sex with her. She resists. He stabs her in the back, in the lower back, with a wooden-handled, metal-tined hair pick. He then strangles her. They arrest Keith Bush, and he is not released from jail until 2009 on parole. And that was 1975. So they go to trial against Keith Bush, and the evidence that they introduce at trial is the following. They claim that they recovered fiber evidence under the victim's fingernails that matched perfectly Keith Bush's jacket that he wore at the time of the party. They introduced Maxine Bell's testimony, basically saying that she saw Keith Bush and Cerise Watson leave the party together, making Keith Bush the last person seen with the victim and, in fact, leaving the party. They introduce the confession, of course, and they introduce some other witnesses that say, yes, they saw Keith Bush, they saw Cerise Watson at the party. Keith testifies at trial, claiming that he was forced to sign the confession, that he was beaten and psychologically tortured. He also produces an alibi witness. He's ultimately convicted after...
When you say an alibi witness, what do you mean?
That he remained at the party until 3 o'clock a.m. and then left the party with that individual. And I'll talk a little bit more about his alibi in a moment. He's convicted. He's sentenced to 20 to life. It means he's eligible for parole starting at 20 years. And he maintains his innocence throughout his time in prison. He files a number of direct appeals, collateral attacks on the conviction. In fact, he's denied parole because he never, in large part, because he never accepts responsibility, according to the parole board. Of course, in his view, he was simply maintaining his innocence. And when I interviewed him, I asked him, you know, if you knew admitting guilt would result in your early release from prison, why didn't you just admit guilt? And he said, I wasn't going to let them do to me as a man what they did to me as a boy. And what he meant by that was, of course, taking his dignity and humanity away from him. So he files a petition with my office in 2018. We started a new bureau called the Conviction Integrity Bureau. It's designed to investigate claims of actual innocence of those individuals who allege they're wrongfully convicted.
So why did you start that?
We started that in large part because Suffolk County has a history, has a troubled history with respect to its criminal justice system, both in the past and in the not too distant past. And what I mean by that is there was an investigation that was revealed in the 80s and 90s by the State Investigation Commission, and they found that the homicide squad back then, I'm talking 70s and 80s, had an unusually high confession rate. They also found certain instances of misconduct in certain cases, like the planting of evidence. So you had that history. And then when I took office, my predecessor, he's federally indicted for obstruction of justice, and along with the former chief of department of the Suffolk County Police Department. So you have this history.
I'm sorry, could we just stop there for a minute, because that's fascinating. What indeed was the obstruction of justice charge?
Sure. This is a whole nother saga, but it's worth diverting some time to. So to answer your question, in short, they're both indicted by the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Eastern District of New York, which is the U.S. Attorney's Office that covers Suffolk County, among other counties. Essentially, what is alleged, and part of this has been confirmed because the former chief of department has already pled guilty to at least part of what I'm about to say. The allegation is essentially that James Burke, the former chief of department, his car was broken into, and the suspect, the individual responsible for breaking into his car, was arrested, and James Burke went to the precinct and assaulted the suspect. Now, keep in mind, this is the 11th largest police department in the country. This isn't five police officers hanging out in a police station. This is a police department with a budget of almost $1 billion when you consider employee benefits, 2,500 police officers, 1,000 civilian employees. It's a major police department. You have the highest ranking uniformed officer in the department assaulting a prisoner. So, you know, pretty terrible stuff and embarrassing. In any event, he then proceeds to cover it up because there are witnesses. So there's a federal investigation of this incident. There's a state prosecution of the suspect where people are pressured to cover up what actually happened. And he's charged with obstruction of justice. About a year later, the U.S. Attorney's Office then indicted the DA, Tom Spoda, for participating in that obstruction of justice conspiracy. He's scheduled for trial in November. So he still has his presumption of innocence. Burke has already pled guilty and acknowledged that the allegations are true. So you have that, and then you also have what I mentioned before with the SIC report, which dates back to conduct from the
SIC, State Investigation Commission?
Yes, sir. Okay, yeah, and that dates back to the 70s, the 80s. And it, you know, this is really fascinating, and I don't want to get too much off of Keith Bush, but what's really interesting is that the report, the 70s, the report about allegations of misconduct in the 70s and 80s, they involve cases that Tom Spoda and James Burke were involved in. So it's full circle. It's actually incredibly disturbing in some respects. It makes for a good Grisham novel maybe one day.
I should say.
But the way Burke and Spoda meet each other is Spoda is the prosecutor, the homicide prosecutor on the Pius case. Pius was a high-profile murder. Suffolk County, a young boy was killed. The perpetrator shoved pebbles down his throat. And Burke was a witness, a child-aged witness in that case.
Wow.
And that's how Spoda and Burke, as the story goes, first met. Then Burke became his protege. Burke rose through the ranks in the police department in large part because Spoda was his mentor and was his
rabbi,
exactly. Mm-hmm. And Burke became the head of the DA squad, which is an elite group of detectives assigned to the Suffolk County District Attorney's Office. And then from there, he was made the chief of department, largely by recommendation of the then District Attorney, Tom Spoda. So anyway, you have this history, right? So that's why I thought it was very important to start the Conviction Integrity Bureau. And
was there any political motivation? I mean, you have an 11% black population. Clearly, they had to be somewhat suspicious of the DA's office. And you as a politician, elected politician, would be responsive to that?
Sure. Yeah, I would characterize it as an attempt to restore public confidence in law enforcement and to continue to build relationships with all of our communities, including communities of color. And that's what we did. What we did was we talked to and or visited many, if not all, of the conviction integrity units and bureaus throughout the country. Talked extensively with the Brooklyn DA's office, who was one of the pioneers on this front.
For good reason.
Right. Similar situation
yeah.
with respect to the detective there. We have, we'll get to it in a moment, but as I mentioned, Keith Bush, his allegation is that he was beaten and tortured and forced to sign a false confession. And the detective involved in that case, as a detective named, there are two detectives, Detective Rafferty, Dennis Rafferty, and he's named in the SIC report. So it's somewhat of a similar situation when you think of the Brooklyn situation.
When Bush talked to you about how he was tortured, did he actually tell you what exactly they did to him?
Yes.
Which was?
They beat him with a telephone book. He actually said a thick, he didn't say telephone book, he said a very thick book that seemed like a telephone book. They kicked him in the genitals and they would pin him down and not let him move. They threatened to never let him go home. They threatened to never let him see his mother again. Keep in mind, he's 17, right? And we know now, due to science and due to experience, that younger people, their brains aren't fully developed and they're more susceptible to psychological pressure. So what's interesting about this case, so we get this petition, and the first thing we do is we review the file. And this is where it gets really interesting. We find in the file a statement signed by John Jones, a 21-year-old man at the time of the murder of Sharice Watson from Wyandanch, which is another town in Suffolk County. In this statement, he says he was at the party, he got drunk, he left the party, got sick, tried to walk to his sister's house, tripped over the body of Sharice Watson, dropped his plastic hair pick, black plastic hair pick, then went back to his sister's house, went to his sister's house. When Sharice Watson's murder was all over the television, he realized, oh, wow, that's the girl I stumbled over, never told anyone. So how does he come in contact with the Suffolk County Police Department? Big mystery. What we know is that the murder happened in January. We know that he's talking to police about this, what I just told you, his statement. That statement's given in May, the same year. We know that he was arrested on April 18th, 1975. So perhaps there's something in connection with his arrest. He was arrested for an unauthorized use of a stolen car. Perhaps someone dropped a dime on him. Perhaps he was linked somehow to the murder. Perhaps he got spooked and gave something up. In any event, the police are talking to him about Sharice Watson's murder in May. He makes this ridiculous statement about tripping over Sharice Watson's body and leaving his hair pick at the crime scene. And of course, his hair pick was recovered from the crime scene. Now, this is months after they have Keith Bush arrested and indicted. And Keith Bush is in the media saying that he's innocent and that he was beaten and tortured to sign a false confession. So what do they do with John Jones? Now, of course, anyone with half a brain...
You know John Jones is a natural suspect.
Of course. He's not only a natural suspect, the most probable suspect. Mm-hmm. So one would then want to investigate John Jones. Well, that's not what happens here. Instead, what they do is they have him take a polygraph administered by the Suffolk County Police Department on May 1st, 1975. We don't know anything about that polygraph other than that the results were not unequivocal. Further testing was required. They then send him to another polygraph in July of 1975. And the polygraph uses a method that is completely unreliable. And it also asks him certain questions. For example, did you kill Sharice Watson with a hair pick? And he says no, but we now know, and I'll explain in a moment, she wasn't stabbed with a hair pick. So he could have truthfully actually answered that question. But most importantly, they conduct no investigation whatsoever. They attempt to wash it by sending him to this bogus polygraph. And then the worst part is they never disclose it to the defense. So it's a massive Brady violation. It's not disclosed to the defense until my office discloses it to Keith Bush's attorney in 2018, which is at the beginning of our investigation. So we find this statement, and we then launch a massive investigation. We assign three prosecutors, two detective investigators. We work in close collaboration with the new administration in the Suffolk County Police Department, with the medical examiner's office, which houses our crime lab, as well as an outside lab, and just as important, with defense counsel. It's a very collaborative process. Open file, and we share information with the defense, and they share information with us, including subjecting Keith Bush to an interview. So we do this investigation. We interview dozens of witnesses. We re-examine all of the evidence. We find new evidence and analyze that, and we come to some basic conclusions. So let's start with the evidence at trial. The fiber evidence that I mentioned, junk science. There's no way they could have offered that opinion that the fibers taken from the victim's fingernails matched Keith Bush's jacket. So that's out. In fact, in 2006, DNA evidence excluded Keith Bush, male DNA from underneath the victim's fingernails. Let's talk about Maxine Bell. She gave a statement in 1975, allegedly. She testified for sure in 1976 that she saw Keith Bush leave the party with Sharice Watson, and they walked out together, in fact, and they started to hook up, and that's when Maxine Bell turned away and they walked off. That's the last Sharice Watson seen, according to Maxine Bell's testimony. 1980, she completely recants. And her recantation, we find credible. At the time, a judge found it incredible. Now, recantations are subject to scrutiny under the law. Nonetheless, we have reason to believe that her recantation is credible. Why? Because we don't believe she was ever at that party. And there's a number of reasons why. But first of all, not a single person, then or now, puts her at the party.
Did she say she wasn't at the party in her recantation?
Absolutely. She said she was never at the party.
And do we know why she recanted?
Well, what she says was she was a scared young girl. She was 15 years old at the time. She was a runaway, as I mentioned. She got picked up by the police. She was reported missing. She was, in fact, reported missing at the time of the party. She was picked up by the police a couple days after the party. And she said that she told them what she thought they wanted to hear. And she thought that would be the best way to get home and to stay out of trouble. And that she's been living with the guilt and shame of this her entire life. She recants in 1980. She moves out of Suffolk County. She gets married. She actually marries a police officer. And she says she feels she's more mature. She has more of a support network. And she feels that she can come forward and tell the truth. So she's called around 1980 to testify.
Who does she go to when she decides?
The Suffolk County District Attorney's office. So they call her to come testify in a post-conviction proceeding. Keith Bush has filed a number of different appeals, and this was one of his first. And she, when she's called, she says, well, I'm willing to cooperate, but I need to tell you that I lied during my testimony. I wasn't even at the party. And they record her statement, and they produce her, and they put her on the stand, but the judge finds the recantation incredible.
Is the judge in on it?
There's no indication at all that there is misconduct
When I say in on it, I mean, was the system so wink-wink that the judge was going to go along with the DA, and certainly not on this recantation?
You know, like I said, on the recantation issue, the law is certainly skeptical of recantations. And this was the first sign of this case falling apart, so I wouldn't want to be overcritical of that judge. Now, that judge was the trial judge. So just systematically, that's an interesting dynamic, right? You preside over a case, you preside over a conviction, and then you're presiding over a post-conviction collateral attack. So systematically, you know, one may ask, is that the best system? So Maxine Bell's half-sister, Sharon Holmes, is at the party. And she even says she doesn't see Maxine Bell there. So obviously, there are a bunch of people at the party that know Maxine Bell, including the half-sister. She's missing at the time. If they saw Maxine Bell, they would remember that. So you have fiber evidence is out. You have Maxine Bell's testimony out because of the recantation. Now let's talk about the confession. Keith Bush's whole allegation has been that he was forced to sign a false confession. Well, we've now determined that the confession is false in two material respects. The confession claims that the perpetrator, the confession says Keith Bush, basically attempted to rape Sharice Watson, and then when she fought back, the perpetrator stabbed Miss Watson in the back with a wooden-handled, metal-tined hair pick, and then strangled her to death. Let's talk about the hair pick. They introduce a hair pick at trial. It's not the plastic black hair pick that they found at the crime scene, which John Jones says is his, but this other hair pick. Where do they get this hair pick? Well, the night of the confession of Keith Bush, the alleged confession of Keith Bush, what happens is they ask Keith Bush, is that your hair pick, the black hair pick at the crime scene? He says, no, I have a wooden-handled, metal-tined hair pick. So they go to his house with a search warrant, and they basically say to his brother, Mark Bush, give us Keith's hair pick. We're not leaving without a hair pick. So Mark calls a gentleman named George Golson, who's a cousin, and he happens to have the biggest afro in town. They know he carries a hair pick. He comes to the house and produces his hair pick. The detectives take that hair pick. That's the hair pick they introduce at trial as used in the murder. What do we know now about that hair pick and the confession? Well, it's forensically impossible for that hair pick to have caused the wounds in Sharice Watson's back for one main reason. The puncture wounds, as I mentioned before, they're in a series of three for the most part. The hair pick, the tines are too wide to have caused those puncture wounds. Second thing about the confession, how is it materially false? That's number one. Number two, the confession reads that she was stabbed and strangled to death. But we know the wounds on her back are perimortem, meaning that they were caused at around the time of death or after death. We know that because of the lack of blood. The puncture wounds go through her white sweater and into her back, but yet there's hardly any blood on the sweater or on the wounds. And that's because her blood's not circulating when she's stabbed. It's because she's either dying or already dead. And we know from the autopsy that she was killed by strangulation. We also know by the coloration of the wounds that they were perimortem. So the confession is false in two material ways. Why would Keith Bush confess to a murder and then lie about the details? Rather, I think a more plausible explanation is that they had a theory, they had a thesis, and they made the confession fit their thesis, but their thesis was wrong.
We're talking to Tim Seney, who is the district attorney, and a very remarkable one, of Suffolk County, New York, the 11th largest police department, by the way, in the United States. So that's extraordinary in itself. But Tim, if I may call you that,
sure.
let me ask you this. Jones clearly now becomes a suspect. Is he still alive?
He's dead. He died in 2006, and that's the tragedy. The time to investigate John Jones was in 1975, and they failed to do it, and he's now dead. What I can tell you about Jones is that his statement makes no sense whatsoever. It's implausible on its face, but it's also implausible for other reasons. So he says that he leaves the party. Well, first of all, not a single witness puts him at the party. He's 21 years old, which is older than most of the people at the party. It was a high school party. He's from Wyandanch. The party's in Bellport. No one claims to know John Jones now, those people who we've interviewed. And we know that he has an interest in younger girls. Why? Because around the time of this murder, he's committing statutory rape of a 15-year-old, impregnated her, in fact. And he's got a long rap sheet. By the time he's arrested in April of 1975, the arrest that I think that actually puts him on the police department's radar in terms of the Sharice Watson murder, he has 11 arrests, and he commits crimes his entire life, and he dies in 2006. We looked for his DNA, right? Because we see his rap sheet. So right away, we're thinking, oh, maybe we can get it. Maybe we have his DNA on file. In fact, we did. So we pulled his DNA, and we tried to compare it against everything we had still. But by the time we did that analysis and our investigation, all the DNA was deteriorated, it wasn't suitable for comparison. We know, though, that we know what he said, right? And what he said was that he leaves the party, which is unlikely, and that he trips over Cerise Watson's body and drops his hair pick on his way to his sister's house. So the chances of this are just implausible. The body is found west of the party. His sister's house is due east of the party. So he walks the opposite direction from his sister's house. And in all this space, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of square feet, blocks we're talking, he happens just to trip over the body of Cerise Watson, which was found in a grassy field, drop his hair pick, not mention anything about this encounter with a dead person, and just go back to his sister's house, and then see the murder on television, but not say anything. But realize, oh, that's the girl that I stumbled over in the dark of night.
Unbelievable.
It is unbelievable because it's not true. And so the basic conclusions we arrived at were, we don't believe Keith Bush committed the murder. Certainly he was denied a fair trial because they covered up John Jones's existence, and that John Jones was the more probable suspect.
It's extraordinary. When did you first talk to Bush?
I talked to Bush, I believe it was February of 2019. That's what I personally did, but my team had spoken to him at least once before.
They come to you and say, boss, we don't think he did it?
So it was an interesting process. When we got the petition, right away my special counsel, Howard Master,
Who was the petition from?
Keith Bush.
Okay.
And his attorney was Adele Bernhard, who ran the Innocence Project at Pace Law School.
Right.
And she's a terrific attorney. And she filed the petition, and my special counsel, Howard Master, who's got an incredible investigative and prosecutorial mind, he actually prosecuted Sheldon Silver. He did the City Time case, which is one of the largest municipal fraud cases in U.S. history. He's done a lot of big cases. He comes from the Southern District, then the New York State Attorney General's office, and then I recruited him. And he came to me and said, there's hair on this one. We better assign appropriate resources to this one. And that was before we knew John Jones.
Wow.
And then when we found that statement, that's when everyone's hair stood up.
So, Mr. G.A., let me go back and ask you, what was the criminal justice culture like in the district attorney's office and the police department at the time that they couldn't do an honest job and really had to frame the guy?
That's a great question. So, an interesting part of this investigation is that the detectives are still alive. And we spoke to one directly, and the other one spoke to us through counsel. Let's start with the one who spoke to us through counsel. His name is Dennis Rafferty. He was named in the SIC report in connection with prosecutions that were suspect. He's now represented by a gentleman who is the law partner of Tom Spoda.
Ooh, the former district attorney.
Yes. Through counsel, the former Detective Rafferty says he admits that they knew of John Jones. He doesn't try to cover that up. He can't, right? The statement's there. Dennis Rafferty's signature is on the statement. Yes, you know, John Jones came about. He didn't tell us how or why. And I had a hunch that he wasn't the killer and John Jones wasn't smart enough to lie to me. And in terms of not disclosing his existence to defense counsel, that was the prosecutor's decision. The prosecutor is dead. His name's Jerry Sullivan. He's also the former law partner of Tom Spoda. Augie Stahl, is the other detective. We approached him at his residence. He lives in a private enclave in Yaphank, New York, that is owned by the German-American Settlement League, which was settled around World War II by Nazi sympathizers, and up until recently only allowed those with German roots to reside until the New York State Attorney General sued them. When first confronted with the Keith Bush investigation by my detective investigators, he said, I remember that case. That effing N-word did it. He should have been executed. Clearly evincing racial animus. He denied the existence of Jones, or at least remembering Jones. And then apparently, according to the media, the news media got to him as well, and to the news media he claimed that he did remember John Jones.
You just mentioned the R word, racism. How much of all of this is racist?
Look, I think you have to ask the question, would this have happened to a white boy in 1975 in Suffolk County? It could, of course, right? And we've had allegations of wrongful convictions of white people in Suffolk County, undoubtedly. But I think we have to be sensitive to the reality that you have a county in 1975 that's mostly white, still is mostly white, and Keith Bush is at a huge disadvantage being a young, not affluent African-American boy in a system that's almost entirely white. The detectives were white, the prosecutors were white, and his jury, with one exception, was white. There was one black juror. So I think if we said, oh, race played no part, I think that would be naive. But at the same time, we need to recognize that I'm not so sure they wouldn't do this to, you know, a white person either. What I think happens here, and it's just me reading in between the lines, and this is where we get into a little bit of speculation, this is a high-profile murder. It's on the front cover of Newsday. There's a lot of pressure to solve this case. They get their guy. It's Keith Bush. They probably honestly believe it's Keith Bush. And then when they realize they got the wrong guy, Keith Bush is already out there saying he was beaten into signing a false confession. There's no turning back. And they railroad him.
And that would have been that he would have had a hell of a law case, right, for damages and everything else.
Well, he has a hell of a law case now.
I'm going to ask you about that. So we're talking to Suffolk District Attorney Tim Sinee. Tim, what could it have been like for a guy sitting in prison for all of those years? Has he said anything to you?
Yes, it's quite incredible. He's really channeled that anger, that frustration, that sadness into something positive. And we often say that about tragedy. And we often say that about people who have turned tragedy into something positive. But here, it's just really amazing that he was able to do that. And when asked, how'd you channel that? You know, he just said, well, I channeled it through, you know, the love of life and desire to be joyful. He felt it would be wasteful to focus on anger. He kept fighting. That was his sort of channel, right? He kept fighting, he kept filing appeals and collateral attacks on his conviction. And he had a great attorney. His attorney who took his case to the end, Adele Bernhard, she's very talented. She had the resources through the law school, and she was continuing to file appeals and collateral attacks. And then when she saw that we opened up the Conviction Integrity Bureau, she came to us.
You've used the word a couple of times. I just wanted to get a definition. What is a collateral attack?
So when you have a conviction, you have the right to appeal to at least the appellate division, a matter of right. And you can claim that certain legal errors occurred or that evidence was legally insufficient. You lose that appeal. You can file a leave to appeal to the New York Court of Appeals, but that's not as of right, and they take very few appeals. After that, the only way to attack your conviction is through what we call a 440 motion, and that's just the statutory provision under the criminal procedure law that allows you to attack your conviction on certain enumerated grounds, including newly discovered evidence, a serious constitutional violation that you didn't know of at the time of your appeal, etc. And so, in addition to a direct appeal, he filed several 440 motions, all of which were denied. Now, they were denied without the benefit of knowing about John Jones.
So tell me, Mr. District Attorney, tell me, did he tell you what that moment was when he basically was exonerated?
Well, we were with him in court. We made a joint application, the defense counsel and myself. It was obviously an emotional moment for everyone, but obviously mostly for Keith Bush and his family. We conferenced the case with defense counsel and the court in chambers, and then we came out to open court, and defense counsel made a motion. Then I argued the motion.
And the motion was that he be exonerated.
The motion was pursuant to criminal procedure law, section 44010, and it was to vacate the conviction and sentence based on the serious Brady violation as well as newly discovered evidence.
And the Brady violation is you have to share your evidence with the lawyers.
Right. Brady relates to exculpatory evidence. So any evidence that is favorable to the defense needs to be disclosed to the defense in a timely fashion so that they can properly use it at trial, so they can properly use it in the defense of their client. John Jones is quintessential Brady. It's the existence of an alternative suspect, which was the very claim Mr. Bush was making at trial, that he didn't do it, and that was entirely suppressed. That was not given to him at all.
So did he share his emotion with you anyway?
Yeah, he did. We left the courtroom. His mother is still alive, so his mother was there. and she was just stricken with emotion.
And how many years was he in prison?
33.
Wow.
And then he was on lifetime parole, registered sex offender. And here's another really sad part of his story. While he was on parole, they violated him, and he went back to prison for a year because he used an internet-connected computer without authorization. And as a registered sex offender, he was not permitted to do that. He was using the computer, according to him, to write his memoirs.
Now, you say he has a hell of a law case coming up. I take it he's pursuing that.
I have no information as to what he's doing. I just know that in wrongful conviction cases like this, the petitioner is typically entitled to compensation.
We're talking with the Suffolk County District Attorney, Tim Seney, and I guess the question is, how corrupted is our criminal justice system now?
Yeah, when you hear stories like this, you know, I think a lot of people will draw the conclusion that the system must be entirely corrupt. And I disagree with that entirely, actually. I think we have to make a few points. One, Keith Bush's story dates back to 1975, and a lot has happened since then. For example, confessions. We now videotape homicide confessions, and I think we should continue to push for the videotaping of confessions beyond homicide. We do so in a lot of juvenile cases and certain sex offenses. We should be broadening the category of where we use video.
Sort of like policemen wearing cameras on them so that, you know, there'd be no doubt about what really happened.
Precisely. In fact, when I was police commissioner, we piloted the first body camera program. And there are limitations to body cameras, undoubtedly. But they are, on balance, a positive for the police, for the community, and for the criminal justice system.
So what's the limitation when a body camera?
Viewpoints. And that's why when I piloted my body camera project, we did dashboard cameras coupled with body cameras.
Right.
You'd be surprised how misleading the footage can be. So with continued advancements in technology and how we place the body cameras and coupling that with other techniques like a dashboard camera on a police car, we can overcome some of those challenges. The other issue with body cameras is it's not to its utility, but it's incredibly expensive to maintain the data. You know, you need to maintain the data and a department the size of Suffolk County, you have to have a cloud-based system where you have to purchase servers, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of servers. You know, what we're seeing now in New York State, we're seeing this push to make changes in the criminal justice system, some of which I agree with, some of which I don't. But what's not helpful is when there are criminal justice reforms with no budget attached to it.
So I wanted to go there, if I may, Tim, and that is, there is a sense that the governor right now, Governor Cuomo, who I talk to quite often, and others have tried to say, okay, look, the system is corrupt. If you're white and you have resources, you get out on bail. If you're black, you languish. And now there's been a reform, which some DAs are not happy about. You want to talk about that for a minute?
Sure. So the bail reform that was recently passed, I think the principle behind it is a good one. No one should be in jail because they can't afford to get out. We shouldn't have a system that has a disproportionate impact on low-income individuals. This sort of problem of low bail, if you will. When I first got into county government, I worked on a project, which the governor was extremely helpful with. We had a state mandate to build a third jail in Suffolk County.
That was Governor Cuomo?
Yes, Andrew Cuomo, yeah. You know, we needed a third jail in Suffolk County like we needed a hole in the head, right? And the whole theory of if we build it, we're going to fill it, right? So the county executive, Steve Ballone, tapped me to come up with a plan to get that mandate lifted. And so one of the first things we did was we looked at low bail. And so we considered anything 1,000 or less low bail, right? And we tried to figure out how can we get these people, you know, out of jail, but assure that they'll return to court. So we designed programs, non-monetary conditions, you know, enhanced supervised release, things like that to assure their return to court without keeping them in jail. And in fact, the governor worked with us and we lobbied the Commission of Corrections and they lifted the mandate to build that third jail. And that was the right decision. It was a good criminal justice decision because we then invested in alternatives to incarceration. And it saved the Suffolk County taxpayers hundreds of millions of dollars. So the idea behind the bail reform is a good one. I think we need to expand the number of offenses that qualify for bail. So right now, the way the bail reform legislation works is that there's a presumption of release for most offenses, and there's cash bail is not permitted for most offenses. The offenses that you can ask bail for are too limited. For example, and this is an example of them reacting and listening and doing the right thing, but initially, murder conspiracy wasn't even included.
And, wow.
And I had a case. We arrested several MS-13 gang members for murder conspiracy.
I was just going to ask you about them. Yeah.
And so I called my senators. Fortunately, I have senators in Suffolk County who pick up their phones and talk to their district attorney, and they're
I would if I were them.
And they're reasonable, and they talk to the stakeholders, right, which is important. That's Senator Monica Martinez and Senator Gorin, Senator Brooks. And they then, through working with Senator Kaminsky in Nassau County, they were able to include conspiracy in the second degree. But there are several other statutes that should be included in the bail statute. So the idea behind the bail reform, it's good. I'd like to see it amended. I know Senator Gorin is working on an amendment to add some offenses to the cash bail program, the cash bail scheme.
So if some, I'm sorry to interrupt him, but if some really bad guy from MS-13 comes forward and you catch him doing something really despicable, you know, maybe not murder, but really despicable, drugs, this kind of thing, and bail reform, the so-called bail reform comes out, it may well be that that guy's going to be running around.
That is correct. I mean, because you mentioned drugs. Most drug offenses are not included in the bail statute. So you're talking about major drug dealers are not going to be eligible for bail. You know, they have the major drug trafficker statute in there, but that is reserved for the highest level of drug offenders.
So when you say not available for bail, you mean...
release.
They release them and they go out. And these are people who think nothing of popping somebody if they have to, or we know all about that.
That's right. And again, I think the idea behind bail reform is good. I think the specific legislation in many respects is good. It's just it leaves too many offenses out to be eligible for bail. We need to increase the number of offenses. You know, we need to add certain violent offenses, and we need to add certain drug offenses.
So you said the governor had been helpful to you on the third jail question. This governor also has been a proponent of bail reform. Did you duke it out with him?
No, quite the opposite. The governor, in many respects, has, I think, been a voice of reason, and his office has been very helpful in reaching out to the district attorneys throughout the state and getting the Senate and the Assembly to a more reasonable position, a position that protects public safety.
Well, we're on the subject, district attorney, marijuana reform in New York. We've had many people here arguing that marijuana is not yet a proven issue. Somebody might be driving along, and they may be weaving in and out. They may be caught, and we don't have any way of proving that they're high.
It's a big problem. You look at states like Colorado. You know, fatalities are up in Colorado. All sorts of secondary effects of legalization are occurring in Colorado. And roadway safety is a major priority of my office in the Suffolk County Police Department. We live in a suburb.
Well, they're all crazy out there anyway, the way they drive, as I remember it.
Yes. I should come to the defense of my constituents, but I will say that Suffolk County residents tend to drive too fast, and they can get distracted, and it's a major issue that we're trying to combat in Suffolk County. We're 911 square miles. It's a big county. We get around in our cars, right? And unfortunately, we see too many people die on our roadways. We've made a major push in the last several years to reduce those fatalities. And we have each year for the last several years, we have. But it's still too many. Too many young people. I can't tell you, those are the saddest and most difficult cases. They really are, because the victim, they don't wake up and assume a certain risk other than driving, right? You know, it's not as if they are taking drugs or affiliated with a gang, or, you know, they get in their car and they drive and someone else makes a horrible decision and takes their life. And when the detectives and the prosecutors have to work with the victim's family members and the loss and the sudden loss, you just can't describe it. can't describe it. And they're difficult cases, too, to determine what type of charges, if any, to bring, right? Sometimes they're just accidents. Tragic, but they're accidents and not crimes.
Well, I don't know. When Other I go times, on the Southern State Parkway, I think it's wicked.
Yeah.
I just hold on for dear life.
Yeah, and reckless driving.
People coming around me one way or the other, going from lane one to lane three right in front of you. It's incredible.
Reckless driving is an issue. And then when you combine speed and you combine drugs, you combine alcohol, it's a recipe for death.
So you think it's a mistake to do marijuana in New York, legalize?
We're in the midst of a drug epidemic. And it may not be popular to say, but it's a fact that the two gateway drugs to opioid abuse are marijuana and alcohol. And the other issue to keep in mind is that the marijuana that's on the market today is extremely potent. THC levels are through the roof. And we need to keep that in mind when we're legalizing. You know, there's two different issues here, right? There's decriminalization of marijuana possession, and there's legalization, which is providing a market by which folks can sell and buy marijuana. And we don't yet have decriminalization in New York State, at least 100%. I think it's a good thing that the lawmakers are pumping the brakes on this and talking to the stakeholders. What I keep telling my senators and what I tell folks is talk to law enforcement, talk to health service providers, talk to lawmakers in Colorado, because they're experiencing a lot of issues that I do not want to see happen in New York.
We've been talking with Tim Seney, District Attorney of Suffolk County, New York, about the longest-running murder case to be overturned in New York State history. I got to tell you, Tim, I am incredibly grateful that you have shared this story with us, because it is a hell of a story. Thanks so much for sharing this with us, and we hope that the next time you're back in Albany, you'll come by and we'll do another hour, because you're good at this. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been fun.